Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. So, joining me for this first episode is Kate Jackson, who, as you all know, blogs at Cross Examining Crime. Hello, Kate.
Hello, JJ.
How are things? You all right?
Yes, I'm good, and I'm raring to go for our conversation.
Awesome, superb. So I emailed around a few people to ask the sorts of things that they would be interested in talking about, and one of the topics you came back with, and what we're going to talk about today, was the female sleuth in detective fiction.
Yes, we are, because I think I am quite a fan of books with female sleuths, and I think I have expectations of what makes a really good sleuth.
Mm.
And one of the things I was thinking about, sort of running up to this sort of chat, was that I think female detectives, in classic crime at least, get less of a chance to shine over like a long period of like a series.
Okay.
So I sort of think when they first appear in their first book, they're quite proactive, they're capable, they're what you'd expect them to be. But then as their series continues, and they usually end up with a spouse at some point and or children, their ability to sleuth kind of diminishes over time. And I often think that the people who get the longest series are the nitwits, whereas the really capable, competent people get one book and that's your lot.
Okay. So the thing that immediately springs to mind in that regard is the Jeff and Hala Troy novels of Kelly Ruse.
Yes.
Because I know the first book, Made Up to Kill, starts off with Hala Troy as very much the primary sleuth. And then her husband, Jeff, comes in and starts helping her out with the investigation. And I mean, I've only read the first four, I think, because they were the only ones that were available when the Rue Morgue reprinted them, or before the Rue Morgue stopped reprinting them. And certainly, Jeff takes on a larger and a larger role in those narratives as they go. I wonder the extent to which that matches the experience of writing them, because my understanding of those books is that Audrey Kelly, who was the female half of Kelly Ruse, started off trying to write a novel on her own, trying to write a detective novel on her own, and then her husband, William Ruse, started scratching away at her and wanting to be more involved, and then started to have more and more input. And in that first book, you can almost feel that, because you see Hala being very much the primary sleuth, and then you kind of get the impression that as William Ruse kind of ingratiates and probably irritates her more in real life, Jeff starts to take on more and more of a role.
Yeah, and I think the way her sleeping role diminishes is very rapid. I think hers was like one of the most rapid downturns. I'm still trying to recover from the ending of If the Shroud Fits, where I think, yes, you remember that one.
I do.
Where I think spoilers ahead, Hala Troy thinks that she's getting like gassed to death in a room, but actually she isn't. She's just like a panic attack. She's basically thinking it is and then passes out as a consequence, but she never actually was in any danger at all.
Mm.
And I'm just like, oh, come on, woman. You've got no sleeping role. The least you could do is be a vaguely sensible, captured person. You know. But no, she couldn't even manage that. I think another writer where we see this happen is Lenore Glenn Offord. Have you heard of her?
I have not.
Ah, well, you should be reading my blog a little more closely than you would. Mm-hmm. Well, I've only read about maybe sort of three of her novels. One of them is from her Todd and Georgina series.
Okay.
And in the first book, Skeleton Key, we've got, you know, working woman, got a child, a widow, off to work. She's, like Hala Troy, is the central sleuthing figure in that book.
Mm.
And obviously then she meets her future husband, Todd, who has a little bit of a role. But all the subsequent books, Todd is the one who does all the sleuthing, and then she takes a sort of a back seat.
Hmm.
Whereas with Offord's non-series novels, she actually has some very capable, very sort of spunky, determined, gumptious women. So you've kind of got, in My True Love Lies, you've got Noel Bruce, who's an army driver. And in The Nine Dark Hours, you've got Cameron Ferris, a hardware clerk. And even by their names, there's avoiding being these sort of ultra feminine people, and also they're in the middle of, like, you know, sort of war work in America, yet they never get like a second book, which I always thought was a bit of a shame, really.
What era were these Offord books from?
I think she started writing late 30s, and the ones I've read are in the sort of early 40s, so definitely like during the war. And also, the war is part of the setting.
I wonder the extent to which the sidelining, if you like, of the female sleuth is very much a result of the era in which things are being written, combined with, I suppose, the purpose of the novel of detection. Because I suppose you think back over the, in inverted commas, great detectives of fiction, I think a lot of the time what we come up with, even if they're written by female authors, what we come up with are male names. Everybody starts with Sherlock Holmes, or you've got Joseph Rouletabille from Mystery of the Yellow Room by Gaston Leroux. Obviously, Hercule Poirot, Gideon Fell, Peter Whimsey. So, I mean, the typical, I suppose, great detective is male. And so I wonder if, firstly, women were not really considered seriously, should we say, as sleuths, partly because it wasn't seen as that part of a role, but also because the purpose of the novel of detection wasn't really to get involved in those kind of social issues. And so someone like Dorothy Sayers, who went on to write an incredibly complex female character in Harriet Vane, could have spent time in the novels establishing how socially uncommon it would be for a strong, independent female character to lead a murder investigation, let's say. But conversely, that wasn't what the novel of detection was set up to do. The novel of detection would rather spend its time on detection, and so I suppose got into the trope of it being a male detective, because then it would just, it could just be, again, in inverted commas, acceptable, and sort of free the novel up to focus on the detection. What do you think?
Yeah, I like that idea. And I think your idea chimes in with something that Howard Haycraft said in Murder for Pleasure. Because he actually said that having like a female character as like the central primary detective was a violation of the probabilities, if not the strict possibilities. So he kind of just didn't think it was very probable to have a female character in that role. And I partially think that for younger female characters, the problem was that with literary conventions, we have the hero and the heroine. And the detective, I think, has been sort of more aligned with the hero role. But the problem with the female character is she's trying to straddle the hero detective role, but is still kind of burdened down with the heroine expectations of, you know, romance and love and being rescued. And I think depending on which side the character lands on, it will then skew how much sleuthing you get done.
The idea of the very traditional female role is, I think, quite correct and undeniably accurate. But it's interesting to see sometimes authors work in their female characters, not necessarily in a direct sleuthing perspective. I mean, I'm thinking of the spouse of the sleuth who ends up being a good sounding board, almost becomes like the Watson for the common sense perspective they bring on things. I'm thinking of someone like Lancelot Carolus Smith in Norman Barrow's novels, who has this not exactly fully realized home life, but very much has a home life and has a very almost stereotypical wife, in terms of that she sat at home in front of the fire knitting booties for the baby. But at the same time, there are cases where he goes back and has to bounce things off his wife to get her perspective. Or Freeman Wills Crofts, who I know you're a massive fan of, along with me, his detective Inspector French goes home and bounces ideas off of his wife, Emily. And again, she offers up something which is I suppose, startling to the male mind that a woman can see such depths. But at the same time, is there almost a sense of an acknowledgement of those stereotypical female roles, but also trying to give them a wider role and a wider responsibility inside of the detection without actually being the detective. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is like maybe an easier option, I think, rather than trying to make, you know, like a Lara Croft sort of, you know, detective going out there all guns blazing. Having them at home is, you know, a lot more convenient. But I think it kind of fits in with their more passive role. They have to be the ones to wait. They have to then receive the information that the man's willing to give up before they're then allowed to sort of get involved. And I also think it kind of, they usually at this point go, well, oh, my wife helped me because she knew this bit of domestic knowledge that I couldn't possibly have known. And I think, especially with like the Miss Marple at Tuesday night club murders, the 13 problems.
Yeah.
Well, obviously a lot of hers, like, haha, I know who did it because of the trifles, or because that woman was dieting, or that woman's swim costume.
Yeah.
It was all very much domestic knowledge. And I think through people like Miss Marple, I think writers are trying to kind of give the women a more valued role without changing the role, kind of going, we're not going to change what you're doing, but we're going to give it more emphasis, more value or priority.
And I suppose with somebody like Miss Marple, she's able to have more agency in the detection, I guess. Partly, is it a combination of being written by a woman as well? Do you think that plays a part?
I think, you know, a woman writer may well give her female characters more agency, but I think with Miss Marple, I think it is her age and the type of cases that she gets involved with, I think. So, you know, she has a couple of cold cases, or it's things in her village, the kind of things that she's more naturally going to get involved in, rather than like the sort of cases that Hercule Poirot might get asked to do. There's usually like a difference, I think.
Yeah, because I suppose Poirot does become more sedentary. He does become more of an armchair detective as he ages. I mean, mind you, Poirot already starts off sort of indefinably old, doesn't he? Because he is retired in Roger Ackroyd, which is like the fourth book. So he's already retired by that point. We never know quite how old any of them are, but certainly Miss Marple, well, I'm fairly sure she's described as an old maid quite early on.
Yeah.
Which in the 1930s we know means that she was over 40 years old, you know.
Or could have been even, because I've read some books in the 30s where it says, oh, a woman's 31. Well, that's it. She's on the shelf. I'm just thinking, crap, I don't want to read that. It's about 31. You can't just write somebody off at that age.
So then how many older female sleuths had longevity? There was Miss Silver.
Miss Marple. Mrs. Bradley, she's quite old.
Yeah, she is.
Strange, but old.
Yeah.
Who else? How old is Hildegard Withers? I've always pictured her as a slightly more older person.
I always pictured her as an older person. And then the first Hildegard Withers book I read, she is a school teacher in her 30s.
Surprising. She doesn't sound in her 30s.
What? The way she speaks, do you mean, or the name Hildegard Withers?
I don't know, she just kind of comes across as an older person. And I think on the covers, she's got grey hair. She kind of immediately kind of makes her think she's maybe more in her late 40s to 50s at the earliest. The same with Amelia Butterworth, because when I read her book, I didn't, the thing is called That Affair Next Door, is her first sort of entry into crime fiction.
Okay.
And I always assumed, oh, she must be like, you know, Miss Marple era, 60s, 70s, going onwards. Then when I actually researched her for a post a while back, it's like, she's early 50s. I was like, seriously? She was that young? But I think you always seem to get an impression of women who are sort of in their 40s and 50s as being that much older, because normally they're sort of, their description, their physical description is sort of like, haggard and, looking like they've kind of gone through several world wars and the apocalypse or something. It's just like, she's only 42. Don't have to be that harsh.
So is there then, there's a clear division, isn't there, in the expectations around a female sleuth? She is either very young and a bit flighty and quite pretty and probably going to meet a man she marries at some point in the first couple of books, by which point, or sorry, after which point, I should say, she is then potentially sidelined out of the action.
Hmm.
Or she comes in much later in life, you know, this completely over the hill 55-year-old woman who's obviously got everything useful is behind her. And there isn't a huge amount that deals with that middle age, indeed, of middle age, which is probably where I picture most of the male sleuth. I mean, even when you say Poirot is however old he was at the start of the series, there's something about, I suppose, possibly it's David Suchet's portrayal of him and Albert Finney's portrayal of him and Peter Ustinov's portrayal of him. You know, there are this kind of late middle age portrayal of this guy.
Yeah.
Gideon Fell always strikes me as being somewhere in his late 50s, early 60s. Same thing with Henry Merivale. Whimsy is obviously a little bit younger, but he's still old enough to have been through a war. So is there an element of, whether it's authors or whether it's the genre as a whole, not knowing what to do with a woman between the ages of 30 and 50?
Yeah, I think you're right. There is, I think, quite a gap there. And the only exception I can really think of would be Harriet Vane, because I think she is in her 30s. I might be wrong, but I thought she was in her 30s. And I think it does take Sayers quite a while to kind of build her character in, and always has to start her off, you know, being on trial, you know, for being a sexually unconventional woman. She has to kind of start quite boldly to kind of find a place for her.
Yeah.
And then because she's had that more greater life experience, what she goes on to do makes a lot more sense. Because one of the problems with, you know, the younger, you know, 20-somethings is that they've got no life experience. And Dorothy L. Sayers actually says that, you know, they're all driven as the white snow. They're innocent. They have no life experience. Yet somehow they're supposed to solve this incredibly complicated case. You know, how are they going to do it? So I always think, perhaps people think, well, I'll make the person older, like 50s plus, because then all their life experience will flood in and sort of help solve the case.
And then what you said stands, because the expectation of their life experience by that point is very homely, very homespun, very centered, a lot of the time centered around domestic issues. Or in the case of Mrs. Bradley, it's just completely made up nonsense psychology. I think that's an excellent point. I think that's an excellent point.
One exception, I think, to perhaps what we've been talking about is Delano Ames' Jane and Diego Burt Brown series. He just does 10 novels.
Yep.
And I think that they are quite young, perhaps in their maybe later 20s, possibly getting into their 30s by the end of it. And they're quite an interesting sleuthing team, because yes, sort of Diego Burt is the maverick sleuth who kind of wanders off and suddenly I found that out, I've done this odd thing and I've, you know, got this information out of that person. And you kind of think, oh, he's the main sleuth. But I think Jane somewhat steals the limelight because she's the narrator. So she controls the narrative, and how her husband is depicted depends on her.
Yes.
And she's perfectly happy with tripping him up and almost sort of making him look, you know, slightly, you know, kind-hearted but irresponsible. Mm. And she's almost like, she's kind of like the zookeeper on, you know, on this sort of, you know, mad escapade of, you know, trying to be the practical one of, yes, we do need to find some employment so we have a roof over our heads, you know, silly things like that.
Mm.
Now, I really love one bit. I think it's in Death of a Fellow Traveller. And I think Diego Burt has been chatting to a very good-looking young woman, which I don't think Jane was too impressed about. So when he comes back and says, you know what, we should do a reenactment of the death, which I think was falling off a cliff. And she was like, that's great, you be the corpse and I'll be the killer then. Just, you know, happy, intimating, I will chuck you off a cliff at this point.
Yeah.
So I kind of think, even if she doesn't always have an equal sleuthing role, though I think she does actually do her own questioning of people and getting involved, I think she kind of holds her own by being the person who controls what's being said and what's being written.
Interestingly, though, in the Kelly Ruse books, it is Haler who is the narrator. And yet, somehow, she still manages to feel sidelined.
Yeah, she doesn't really give a great impression of us.
She doesn't. No, she doesn't. But it's interesting, because I think what you say is quite right. There's a lot about being able to control the narrative that gives a very good impression of a particular character, or it gives us a certain impression of a character. But it is interesting that that in and of itself is insufficient, right, in terms of being able to guarantee that character appearing to have agency or appearing to have some controlling element or some contributory element, I suppose, to what is actually happening inside of the book.
June Wright's Maggie Burns is another kind of example of that, to the first person narrator and the female sleuth. And I think she actually does hold on to being the primary sleuth in both of her books. But of course, that's the shame, is she's a really capable, determined character, and all she gets is two books, which is rather unfair. But I think in So Bad a Death, she actually proves you can be married, you can have a two-year-old child, and you can still be a proper amateur sleuth. You can go around asking questions, you can get yourself into danger a bit, but not stupidly so. And she has to combat, you know, sort of her husband kind of going, if you keep sticking your nose in this, I'm not going to let you buy the house we're currently renting. You know, that kind of comes, that pressure to stay out of it.
Yeah.
And I think she actually, you know, sort of mounts quite a good defence and still holds on to her position. Though, interestingly, the case does revolve around young children, potentially their lives are in danger, and childcare itself. So I don't know whether actually rooting the case in her sort of person of subject knowledge maybe sort of helped it, rather than sort of saying, oh, you're a three-year-old child, please go and solve this case in a chemical factory or something, which might have been quite a leap.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So I know as well, I have yet to read any of Juanita Sheridan's Lily Wu books, but I know you're a huge fan of Lily Wu. Do you think the Lily Wu books are aided by the fact that there isn't a competing male presence at the centre of the books? Am I right in saying that the books are effectively based around two women investigating together?
Yes, I was actually going to bring them up myself, because that's an interesting thing, where, as you say, there is no competing male protagonist, because the police are in the background. But in the first book, they're almost a threat in and of themselves to Lily Wu, who is more likely to get accused of the murder. Because she's a young Chinese woman in 1940s America, she's likely to be the scapegoat. So the police aren't her friend, and she's therefore the main kind of sleuthing focus. And then, I thought it was really good. Over the four books, Lily never has male admirers. She obviously kind of goes on dates. We can kind of get hints of that. She's very, in demand, but she never has a boyfriend or a husband. Yet the really interesting thing is that she's not sort of made out to look like she's weird or, too ugly to get a man, or, there's nothing sort of seen as wrong with her or her singleness. It's actually seen as, no, there's two young women, loving life, doing their work, solving cases. And I kind of thought that's quite unusual for the era. Normally singleness is something you're trying to get out of.
Yeah, that is. I wonder how revolutionary that was at the time of publication. I wonder if that was picked up as a revolutionary thing as well.
I don't know, but I feel like it was, because in my sort of reading of 40s and 50s, I've not really seen sort of an equivalent, I don't think. That could just be my sort of lack of reading, though.
Well, I mean, there's always more to read, isn't there? That's the beautiful thing about reading.
Yeah, and a later example would be from the late 1980s and sort of 1990s is Jennifer Rowe's Verity Birdwood series.
Okay.
Again, she gets six books, lucky woman. And again, she's this very sort of intelligent, sort of together woman. She's capable and she's single throughout, and a little flirtations here and there. But she's, again, not seen as weird for not having a man in tow.
I'm just thinking, I can't remember when it came out, but if we're starting to come more into the modern era, there was, what is it, Cordelia Gray, P.D. James is an Unsuitable Job for a Woman.
Yes.
Which, I mean, in itself is a wonderful example of the exact trope, I suppose, that we're talking about. And Jane Tennyson as well, from Linda LaPlante's Prime Suspect novels. This idea that even coming into, I think, An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, I want to say it was the early 1970s. And I think the first Prime Suspect was the 80s. So even you know, 40 or so years after we would ordinarily be looking to kind of base this conversation, a woman being a private investigator or a woman being a high-level police officer is in some way still open to a certain amount of derision from the people around them.
Yeah, and I think with P.D. James's female character, she A, only gets two books,
yeah.
And B, I think she still has to fall into that trope of getting into a lot of danger. I know in the second book, isn't like sort of an underground cave in one of them, and she nearly dies in that. So there's still that tendency to stick the female sleuth in some jeopardy where she has to get pulled out, which don't always do with male characters all the time.
No, that's fair. That's fair. So what you say there has got me thinking, because a lot of the time when we look at our amateur detectives or amateur male detectives, they typically encounter some sort of mystery in the course of their jobs. Think of like Helen McCloy's Basil Willing or something like that, who a lot of the time just stumbles into something as a result of his position in society. Going back to this notion of female detection very much relying on domestic awareness and that sort of sensibility of what women would encounter. Can you think of any suitable examples of your amateur female professional detective? I know June Wright's first novel, Murder in the Telephone Exchange,
The
mystery comes out of the fact that her female central character works in the telephone exchange. Anything else you can think of?
Sarah Keaton, her nurses come up as like a sleuths who can encounter cases through their work. I think nurses is one of the most plausible ones. Because I think, if she's kind of got, you know, Mrs. Bradley and her being a psychologist, and Miss Pym was a psychologist as well, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the problem with female sleuths was how to get them to repeatedly encounter a murder. So often they will encounter it in the first book in their job. So going back to Jane, Delano Ames' Jane Brown, it's in her office where she works where the murder takes place. But then the jobs they have don't tend to lead to, you know, you can't have a murder in someone's office for every book, otherwise people would stop working there or stop visiting. And people feel a bit awkward, I think. Maybe Wright felt a bit awkward about having a female equivalent of a male man who just wanders about being kind of slightly well off and educated and just encountering a murderer as he travels about.
Mm.
I think there's a sort of an uncomfortableness with trying to do a female equivalency with that.
Mm. That comes more from what the perception of the female roles in society were at the time, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, especially, you know, obviously, you know, female police officers were not considered the norm, though I think from early on there was women who would search female prisoners, but I think wasn't it like not until the 1950s when you kind of had more sort of women in the police force doing actual kind of detective-y sort of jobs.
Mm.
Though I think one of the interesting things, we kind of go, you know, pre-1920, was that you didn't often have amateur female sleuths. It was actually more likely to have a private detective. So people like Amelia Butterworth were actually more in the minority, I think, and it was more people such as like the Lady Molly of the Yard, that kind of figure where they're having to work as a police officer or a private detective because they've got no other funds. They know that they're widows or their husband's in prison. Or I think with someone like George Sims, he did like someone called Dorcas Dean, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she only takes up private detective work because her husband goes blind. So it's almost like I'm having to go out of my domestic role because my provider is not able to provide for me.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I think, go on.
I was going to say, whereas once you get to the 1920s, the financial incentive disappears for female sleuths. I also think that it's interesting when widows are used, because I think culturally, because I was sort of doing my dissertation, I was reading up for widows, they're almost seen as these kind of uncontrollable kind of wild entities, because they weren't kind of the young woman who'd be guided by, you know, parents. They didn't have a husband to guide them because they'd pop their clogs. Just these older women who could technically get married again or maybe just have dalliances and would have that extra freedom of respectability, but then had the power to do what they liked. So it seems much more kind of, you know, sort of, you know, uncontrollable.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I'm in the back of my head, part of me has been going, but someone who sits in not exact contrast to this, but I was thinking a nice counterpoint to all of this is Bertha Cool from Earl Stanley Gardner's Cool and Lamb novels, because she has set up a detective agency on her own. The introduction of Donald Lamb in the first book sees things become even more successful, but there are certainly some, I think there's even a couple of books, I think, during the Second World War where Lamb is not around and Bertha has to go and do the detecting herself. I've read them years ago, but you have just reminded me, I'm pretty sure in the first book, she opens the detective agency because her husband has died and she has the money from his death with which to open the agency. So again, there is that idea of the widow having that reputability almost in order to, like, the freedom to go and do this.
Was she treated like sort of comically at all, like, or sort of not be taken entirely seriously?
No, I don't think she is at all. No, I mean, she's quite a hard-headed businesswoman. Hmm. You know, she has a lot of agency. She has, you know, she is very, I mean, I suppose you'd say she's very brave. She's got, you know, like tremendous loyalty. She's very, very business driven, but she's just very loyal, very sort of...
I just find it interesting. You often don't also get all of those positive qualities that you've just outlined. You don't necessarily get them married with looks as well. It's always like you can have looks or you can have them. You can't get both.
Interestingly, I seem to remember she isn't what you would call conventionally attractive in the first book, but it's also not something that she pays any particular heed to. It's almost like she has had no particular cause for that to be relevant, I suppose, to her way of operating.
Because if you get the looks, then you then get, so you have to go off to the altar and get married to somebody. Perhaps an exception I was thinking of is Tuppence Beresford,
Agatha
Christie's Tuppence. Because although in the first couple of books there is the ending where, you know, Tuppence has to get, you know, kidnapped and nearly killed, but I think over the novel, she's one of the ones where there's the most equality between Tommy and Tuppence, because Tommy kind of goes on instinct some of the time, and that's just Tuppence who kind of thinks things out.
Mm.
And I think in sort of M, N or M, we actually find that Tommy's the one who needs rescuing rather than sort of Tuppence, who is much more brave, you know, under fire of danger.
Conversely, though, to go back to that idea of you can't have those positive qualities associated with somebody who is also attractive, how many, or what proportion, I suppose, of male sleuths are considered, or is it less important for a man to be considered attractive? Because I think of someone like Poirot, and a lot is made of how comical Poirot is as a character, and a lot is made of how comical Henry Merivale is as a character, or how comical Fell is as a character. Someone like Christiana Brand's Inspector Cockerill is permanently rolling these disgusting cigarettes, and he's in this shabby slouch hat and this disgusting sort of Macintosh, and he's just, you know, with this belted Macintosh, just chain smoking permanently. So, I mean, is it fair to call out, and I mean, if you feel free to disagree, but is it fair to call out that element of things with female sleuths when really you never get that with the male sleuths? There's always something comical or something faintly grubby or something faintly unappealing about them, in the main, I would say.
I feel like there'd probably be more exceptions to the rule with the men. I can't think of, you know, Lord Peter Wimsey. I think it's like, no, he's like that piece of gorgonzola cheese with maggots coming out of it for a face. It's like, lovely. But then you think, you know, people like Philip MacDonald, sort of the Colonel? Is it Geram?
Anthony Geffen.
And obviously Geffen, yes. Because obviously he's more sort of good looking. But I think if a woman is not attractive, it's sort of more emphasised, there's more description. Whereas if a male guy is nothing to write home about, it's barely mentionable on the page. Because when I think of, you know, Christiana Brand's sleuth, I'm not going, ooh, isn't he grubby with his, you know, Macintosh and his cigarette. I just don't really think about that. And I think, I know on another blog I read this week, that Dead Yesterday, they looked at one of the Drury Lane novels by Hilary Queen.
Yes.
And it's just that whole, I think it's the one where there's the nude sunbathing. And it's just the way that, obviously, you know, the 60-odd-year-old man, the way he's described, you're thinking, you know, he's like some sort of, you know hunky 20-year-old. And you just think that you'd never, ever get a 60-year-old woman in the same plot sort of event. But I feel like sometimes there's some writers feel like, oh, even if a male character's in his 50s or 60s, he's going to be like, no, like a silver fox or something. He's going to still be old. He's going to be kind of dashingly old, as with the silver hair, but it looks really cool. Whereas if an old woman's just got, scraggy grey hair.
Yeah.
So I think there is some, like, a bit of an imbalance in the way that sort of male and female characters are depicted, because either they are better looking if they're male, or if they're not, it's not held against them. Perhaps going back to something we've already kind of touched upon, let's kind of go in a bit more detail. I think there's perhaps a different standard of detection expected by female sort of sleuths, especially perhaps in the sort of 20s, 30s and 40s. Because one of the things I've noticed is that women often in these books, like Doris Miles Disney's Room for Murder, mm-hmm. is where the woman, rather than kind of going around picking up clues, logically interviewing people, putting the pieces together, what she does is she just sort of blunders into a situation, kind of, pokes a few sore spots in people, causes perhaps killer panic and anxiety. And also, it's a catalyst for the other characters around them doing stuff, which then brings out the solution.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think that's probably fair. It is. It's a different standard of contributing to finding the solution. It's almost that sort of the intuitionist school where you're. Detective writer has not quite been able to make all the clues join up, and so the sleuth is walking down the road and just suddenly understands how it all links together. There's that element of sort of accidentallying into something. What that immediately brings to mind for me is Home Sweet Homicide by Craig Rice.
Oh, yes.
Because I think we talk about sleuths, we talk about great detectives, and we talk about male and female detectives. I think there's a tendency... probably guilty of this, we were talking about, women up to the age of about 30 and then from the age of about 55 onwards. Obviously the detectives, such as they are in Home Sweet Homicide, are the three children of a detective fiction author.
Hmm.
And in that regard, it's the youngest, what's he called, Archie, who is the one who does a lot of the blundering around, and his sisters, I want to say Dina and April, are the ones who sort of use him as the series of distractions. So he has the mob, which is this group of boys who just run around causing havoc, and a lot of the time they are there as the distraction, and Dina and April are the ones who are sort of coolly reasoning and rationing everything through. But it's interesting that is what jumps out to me as the exception. I think you're quite right. In a lot of cases, probably what you're finding is the female sleuth stumbling into something, perhaps being a bit uncertain and happening to knock over the dustbin that the dead body has been hidden in or something like that.
Hmm. Yeah, I think with Anthony Gilbert's The Spinster Secret, there's a woman called Janet Martin, who's obviously is a spinster and has a secret.
No way.
But it's her her happening to sort of have tea with this young girl once, that means she realises that when the girl's disappeared, something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
So that's the only way she'd actually have known that there's anything to investigate in the first place.
Mm.
But just to go back to Home Sweet Homicide, I think maybe do the girls have more agency, A, because they're the older ones, and B, because they're still sort of pre-marriage. They kind of got that freedom of not having to be involved in the romance plot.
That's probably fair. I mean, their view of romance is, I mean, they are trying to set their mother up with the lead detective on the case. So there's still definitely that involvement in romance. And obviously, Archie, as a 10-year-old boy, finds the idea of people kissing absolutely disgusting, and so romance is completely off his radar. But no, you're right. There is definitely that element of, certainly they are older, and they are still involved in romance. It just happens to not be their romance plot, I suppose.
I think it's always interesting to kind of contrast their idealistic plans for their mother with her the mother's recollections of her first marriage. She was shackled to a very irresponsible guy who's just a news reporter going around the world to lots of different sort of conflicts and problems. And she just had to keep following him as and when he left. And so it's like, yes, I had to kind of give birth, but like in Spain in a taxi or something. Ridiculous.
That's right.
And she's almost like, she's like, that was okay, but actually looking back, maybe that wasn't right. Whereas I don't think her children are perhaps seeing that side of marriage.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And obviously they are now much more, like they have grown up and have ended up in a much more settled situation. It's obviously through her, she's a mystery author, isn't she? So it's through her providing some sense of constancy and some sense of home life that they've been able to, I don't know, I suppose sort of be as grounded as they are, and I guess then go on to take the interest they do in both setting her up romantically and trying to solve the murder of their next door neighbour.
Yeah, you've given me an idea, actually, when you talk about the mystery writer, because we haven't really touched on that. That is a job that I think female amateur sleuths have some of the time, actually, because it's a more plausible way of getting them involved in murder in a series of occasions. You've kind of got, you know, Ariadne Oliver is another one that sort of springs to mind, Harriet Vane. Mm-hmm. So I think, is that perhaps another sort of solution to the whole, we want to have a female sleuth, but how do we plausibly get her to sort of stumble across a corpse more than once without it being, you know, too ridiculous?
Yeah,
well, it is ridiculous, it not mattering too much.
Yeah, I mean, even, I mean, Harriet Vane at the start of Have His Carcass, when she discovers another body and she's like on the phone to somebody, she's like, yes, I found a body. Yes, another one. Yes, I'm suspected of murder again. Yes, I know. What are the chances? Yeah, but that's true. Yeah, that's true. I'm just trying to think of any other examples and I can't off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm struggling as well. I just thought, oh, there must be tons of them. And I'm just like, I can't think of any. But I'm sure there must be. I'm sure everyone listening will be like, oh, you've forgotten this really obvious one, you numpties.
Well, that's the beauty of giving this to people to listen to, isn't it?
Oh, I forgot. Well, Jane Brown's a mystery writer because she just uses their actual cases as the basis for her novels. So sort of metafictionally, so speaking.
Okay. Is there a sense then that the female protagonist in any kind of mystery became slightly more acceptable post-Second World War when there was this widening of women's roles in society and when the genre started to grow into a slightly more, I guess, a more sort of suspense-y idiom? I'm thinking of something like, what was it called? Is it Death of a Doll by Hilda Lawrence?
Yes.
It was reissued fairly recently.
By Agora Books.
Yeah, and I read it and very much enjoyed it, but didn't have anything to say about it because I was like, this. It felt like it just fulfilled a lot of expectations that I would have of that kind of a book at that time.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting because you've got the male private detective and then you've got two spinsters who've come in. They were originally first appeared in Blood Upon the Snow and then they're now in, I think, The City. But I think the problem was is that there was too many sort of detectives on the case. So often what happened was is the spinster sleuths had very little to do and it was actually the male figure who kind of went around sort of doing stuff.
Mm. But I seem to remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, I seem to remember in that book there's a lot more of your female protagonist getting into dangerous situations and getting into risky situations and then extricating herself and not so much being rescued from them.
Yeah, doesn't she die? I was going to say, she's less of a sleuth and more of one of the sort of victims, I thought.
Mm. I mean, it's Death of a Doll, isn't it? But I was under the impression, because she dies about halfway through, and I was under the impression, in the first half of the novel, I could be entirely misremembering, but the first half of the novel is almost this sort of, it's not H-I-B-K, it's not Had I But Known, it's E-I-R-F, isn't it? Everything is rather frightening. I got the impression she was given a lot more agency being put into this very unusual kind of rooming situation. Her roommate is a woman who's blind. Nobody tells her that she's blind in advance of things. And I seem to remember her ending up in a lot more sort of difficult situations and up to the point where she dies, sort of extricating herself sort of from on the basis of her own initiative. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong.
Perhaps the role of the sleuth is being changed at this point. So it's less about picking up clues and logically sifting through them. It's more of like a thriller sleuth role where you kind of, you land in a situation and you try and get yourself out. You have to then respond to the new events. So perhaps with that kind of more domestic suspense kind of prevalency, the female kind of fitted that role better. Because another two examples I can think of is another Hilda Lawrence novel. I can't remember, novella, is one where there's a paralyzed woman and she's trying to remember what happened that caused her to get paralysis in the first place.
Okay.
And it's as she tries to pick up the memories, and then she realizes that somebody around her is actually the killer, but the killer's holding their fire if they think she hasn't remembered, but the more she remembers, the harder it is to hide it. And obviously then goes down to like a showdown. Mm. And then a similar one is Patricia Carlon, I think that was in the 60s, called The Whispering Wall, where again, there's a woman who is sort of paralyzed, who can't speak, but she can hear the people, like, so that the tenants beneath her are planning a murder of a wealthy relative who's coming to visit. And she's desperately trying to figure out the plan, but then trying to find a way of telling those around her about this plan, about anyone else realizing that's what she's trying to do.
I guess the detection element of stuff very much fell away, didn't it, from female sleuths. They were probably not given, I think we're probably going to be left with these very few examples of female sleuths who had long careers, who contributed to detection in any sort of meaningful way. But then is the flip side of that, that in order to, could it be argued? Could it be argued that in order to give women more meaningful roles in these kind of crime stories, the nature and the face of the genre then went on to change, rightly or wrongly, right? Because the idea that you can't have a female sleuth at the heart of the kind of puzzle plot that, you know, Ellery Queen would write or something is obviously there's no reason you couldn't have that. But is it that for whatever reason, and again rightly or wrongly, the nature of the genre just moved into more domestic suspense in order to expand the roles for female protagonists?
I don't know whether it was a case of we want to make more room for female protagonists, we'll make the change, or whether that the change was happening and people thought, hang on, I can then put a female character into this style quite more easily.
Mm.
And perhaps I think with domestic suspense, it's less about sort of neat endings and sort of tidying things up. Things are allowed to be a bit messier, less perfect. And perhaps, and obviously in a post-war sort of world, perhaps they thought a woman could kind of cope with that, maybe, or sort of respond to it in a meaningful way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd be interested to see what anybody else thinks of that, because, I mean, I certainly, once you get into the 60s and 70s, we are stepping wildly out of my sphere of fictional experience. You know, I've read very little of that kind of stuff. I've read, like, you know, some Jim Thompson when he was kind of writing that late, I suppose, just about John MacDonald, but I mean, really, and some Margaret Millar, but I mean, I haven't read a huge amount from that era, so I'm partly just spitballing. But I do very much get the impression when I think about it, what this has made me realize is when people talk about detective fiction, as I said at the start, and the great detectives, I usually think of male protagonists, and when I think of the domestic suspense of the 50s onwards, I think of female protagonists. I think of something like Beast in View by Margaret Millar or something along those lines, which are obviously much more based in a female protagonist being put in, you know, these incredibly stressful, harmful situations.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether maybe once we start hitting the 60s and 70s, whether perhaps there's a little, you know, female agency is getting, you know, happening a bit more. You are starting to get some more professional police detectives. But at the same time, kind of giving agency alongside that, you'd get more of an explicit sexualization of the female characters at the same time. And maybe that's just, I haven't read enough, but I kind of maybe got a sense of the two kind of went together rather than just having agency without the, you know, sort of objectification at the same time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd love to know. I mean, I certainly have not read enough to be able to comment, but I mean, everybody talks about the 60s being very rich and ripe for the idea of sexual liberation. So the notion that that wouldn't come through in fiction, that doesn't seem right. Yeah. I'm sure there'd have to be an aspect of that, but it is beyond my, I don't have enough experience to be able to comment on that in any authority.
Oh, no, that's fine. Well, hopefully our listeners will be able to fill us in.
Yeah.
I've thought of one writer we haven't talked about yet. I don't know if you've read anything by her, but Ethelina White?
Yeah, I have. I've read, The Wheel Spins?
I think she's an interesting writer because she started in the 30s, now she went into the 40s. But pretty much all of her books, I think I've only read one where it isn't the case, where there's always a lead female protagonist, but she never had series ones. But I think by not having them as series ones, she was happy to kind of repeatedly kind of look at the woman's in danger, how's she going to get out of it, how's she going to solve the mystery which is keeping her there.
Yeah.
And I think she did play around a bit. She wasn't kind of just going like some Patricia Wentworth, there has to be the romance plot of, well, you know, the two young people didn't do it because they're going to get married at the end. You haven't got that certainty. And I love how, I think in Some Must Watch, the lead character is Helen Cappell. And this is the serial killer story where she's in a house in the middle of nowhere, stormy night. And they've locked all the doors, thinking the killer's outside. Eventually she realises, hang on, I think the killer could be on the inside. What am I going to do? But I loved it. In an earlier part of the book, she kind of thinks about the romance element of her situation. She's almost like kind of sort of being a little bit metafictional about it.
Yep.
And she said that, you know, those derided Victorians who looked upon every man as a potential husband certainly detracted every ounce of interest from a dull genus. Yet while she respected the professor's intellect and generally looked forward to the visits of the young Welsh doctor, she resolved to go on buying saving certificates for her old age, for she believed in God, but not in Jane Eyre. Which did actually make me laugh out loud, like, you go for it, you know. I kind of like that. She wasn't kind of banking on getting a bloke by the end of the book, almost. She was still, she kind of going, yes, Jane Eyre's a bit daft, you know, kind of wandering about, you know. So the whole sort of gothic sort of moors and, you know, lady in the tower. She's like, actually, on my own initiative, I'm going to look after myself. That, I kind of thought it was quite refreshing.
That brings to mind the work of Constance and Gwyneth Little as well.
Yes.
Who similarly didn't have a series. I mean, they did have a series, just all of the characters were called different names in every book, but I mean, they could effectively have just been more or less the same letter, right? Because you had a young semi-professional woman living in some kind of an unusual boarding house setup or something like this. Some kind of murder or crime happens. Pretty much the exact same detective comes in and wanders around uselessly in the background while this young woman and usually the young man who she's sort of getting to know. And in fairness, the Littles, they don't always end up in some sort of romantic bliss. And actually, one of the things, I read quite a lot of the Littles before I started blogging. One of the things I appreciated is that you don't always get the romantic subplots playing out in the way that one might necessarily expect, given the trappings of the time. It's the books are quite similar, unfortunately, and so they do kind of blur together after you've read about seven or eight of them. But there's very much that idea, I think, that sometimes that similar idea that sometimes the little heroines have rejected the conventional sort of trappings of marriage. Sometimes they dive into them head first and are delighted, but sometimes there is that sort of suspense around whether or not they are going to do that, which can be quite enjoyable, even if the books do become quite samey.
Yeah, I quite liked how the fact that they didn't always have like an innocent, pure sort of 20-something. I think, I can't remember the title of it, other than being the Black Something. But it's always good, the Black Something. I realised that, I think in one of them, that the young, like, obviously, you know, the female lead, yes, she's young, but she's actually divorced, which I thought was unusual, because normally you don't get your female leads being divorced. And actually, the interesting part of her romance plot is that her ex-husband's back in the area, and it's them having to kind of deal with what they, sort of their sort of their past, and whether what's going to happen. There's no sort of certainty of what's going to happen in the future. She provides a much more sort of prickly, complicated romance subplot, I thought was quite good.
Yeah, that's very cool.
I think with me with romance, it depends how it's done and how much it impacts the protagonist's agency. I'm quite happy for it to sort of just work on in the background or to provide sort of, you know, moments of comedy. But once it starts kind of impinging on any ability to act, like I think Frances Crane's Jean Abbott, or Jean and Pat Abbott series, you know, Jean's a complete and utter nitwit. She's just like, oh, why are you bothering to search the room? Oh, I wouldn't do that. It's awfully disgusting, isn't it? It's just like, how are you in this sleuthing team? You know, how did you get through the interview? You know, or let's just not think about it. It's like, yes, we'll solve the case by not thinking about it. That's a great idea. So you can kind of see why Pat's a bit like, yeah, don't say anything, just sit in the back of the car, I'll deal with it. And you can kind of see where he's coming from, because he's that much of a nitwit. So that's the kind of the romance that would just annoy me. And I think another one is Margaret Sharif's sort of, I think the sort of Henry and Emily Bryce. Again, poor Emily doesn't stand a chance, because Henry just kind of goes, shut up, you're going to say something stupid. And she kind of goes, okay, dear. And you're just like, right, well, that important bit of information is not going to come out for a few more chapters. Great.
Reminds me a little bit of Pam and Jerry North as well.
Oh, yes. I think Pamela's just there for the martinis. I don't think she's there for any other reason.
Right, well, I think we've covered pretty much the range of the female sleuth and everything from about 1920 up to about 1984 there. So thank you, Kate. This has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, it's been really good. Thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
Thank you for being the first episode of my podcast as well. This is you know, exciting new times for everybody, I think. So it's just nice to have these opportunities to, you know, catch up with people and have slightly more extended discussions over what we find interesting.
Yes, it's good, you know, sort of talking to people outside my own household, and it's not a catch, you know.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, I suppose.
Yes, you're not a cat, JJ. Well done.
See, the rumours aren't true. Okay. Thanks again, Kate. We will have to do this again another time. I know you've suggested a couple of different topics that it would be really good to pick over. So,
yeah,
we'll, let's do this again sometime.
Okay, bye.